All right, welcome back. Thank you guys so much for sticking with us. And it is my favorite time of the show. Going to get into the interview, and we are lucky enough to be joined by a friend of the show. Guy, one of our favorite gets to have on here. As always, he's one of the few people that we actually pay for information from. So for those intrepid investors doing this on their own, I'd strongly first suggest you follow this gentleman at Pinecone Macro. That's at Twitter. You can also go to pinecone macro.com. Chase, at any time, if you hear me butchering these, feel free to interrupt. But we're joined by Chase Taylor. And Chase, thank you so much for being with us today.
Yeah, it's always great to be on. Thanks for having me again.
Is it great or is it okay? Right? Like, did you lose
sleep? It'd be better if I was in studio because it's been 100 degrees down here in Southern California the last couple of days.
Oh, okay. Okay. Yeah, but you got AC, right?
Yeah, but it's not outside.
Oh, well, yeah, that's true. That's true. All right. Well, and yeah, it would be better to have you up here. Plus, you know, Pinecone Macro, a lot of this stuff, you know, my theory on you is that you're really a Washingtonian that's just been misplanted. You know, you're born in Texas, you live in Southern California, but you got evergreens in your blood.
Exactly. And it's a matter of time before I end up there.
Attaboy. Attaboy. Hopefully you can come hang your hat with us. Anyway, well, hey, let's get into it. So Chase, I've been warming up the audience, talking about, you know, so many questions we've had about Fed liquidity and what do we mean by printing and blah, 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 blah. And I was thinking about this week because I've encountered that question so many times. And I thought, you know, I firmly believe that context, providing context to things, and maybe it's just how I learn, but I've always been one of those people where, you know, tell me, give me instruction. But one of my, you know, the way I learn is by playing with it, right? Experience it, context, understanding how something works in action. So I thought one of the best ways to tackle this topic would be to kind of split it into three parts. A, what has happened to the American economy in the last 20 years? Because now there are some that would disagree. I mean, you can find people, it seems like, to disagree with any. I mean, there are people out there that believe the earth is flat, for crying out loud. So you could find people that would disagree. I think anybody that has any type of commitment to reality would realize that the economy over the last 20 years, and the stock market in particular, have not behaved like they have in the past. It's a bit anomalous in terms of the results we've seen, the drastic moves up, the drastic moves down. So splitting that discussion and people, so they have an understanding of Fed liquidity and what we mean by all these terms, that they first, I think you need to understand the lead up, right? You got to understand the foundational, where we came from over the last 20 years, when things started to change. And I think that leads us into the part two, which is where we're at, discussing the current situation, where we're at in terms of the structure of the economy, what we're looking at, you know, where we're headed, all that kind of stuff. And I just previewed it. But in third, you know, what that portends, what historical examples we've had of this in the past and what that portends to in the future. So getting us rolling and starting this conversation about where we began. One of the things that I look at, and I think you hear a lot of comps from us and then from a lot of other investors, you know, on CNBC or on other interviews. There's a lot of talk and a lot of comparison to the tech bubble and today, because it really, 1999 is really the only parallel we can draw in terms of valuations on the overall stock market. It's that historically out of line. And so looking back at the tech bubble, where did that, you know, what were the big contributors of that? Now, I don't know how much time you've spent digging into this, but to me, to really understand that move, I think that you have to go back to the late 80s when Greenspan took over for Volcker, because, again, I don't think anybody would argue with the fact that the way Greenspan managed things, the maestro, as they call him, or I don't know if they call him that anymore, but there was a decided sea change in how things were managed, and monetary policy really came to the fore. You know, Greenspan was a... Volcker was much more, you know, let the market do what it does. We're not here to rescue stocks. Greenspan thought, you know, he basically thought the Fed's dual mandate entitled him to run pretty much everywhere. And, you know, we've said before, he was the guy that opened Pandora's box and then burned it, you know, ensuring that we'd never get it back in and never get Pandora back in the box. And I think that that very much led up to the tech bubble. Would you agree with that? What do you think? Do you think liquidity played a role in the tech bubble? And do you think that was really the first time where we saw markets, you know, you had bullish sentiment because of what was going on in the tech world. The other thing I think is interesting to point out are the people that make the comparisons between today's valuations and the tech bubble. In 1999, you had 4% GDP growth. You know, this year, where we have surpassed now, at least on paper, not adjusted for interest rates, of course, but we've surpassed those record valuations on virtually all valuation metrics. But we've done so in a year where, you know, you're going to see a GDP hit in our estimation somewhere between 12 to 15% on the year. So the backdrops couldn't be different. But to me, it looks like there's a similar culprit. There's a similar reason. There's a similar momentum. Do you think the Fed had a lot to play in that tech bubble in the late 90s? Or do you think that was just a classic bubble, just consumer driven, you know, investor driven?
No, it definitely had a lot to do with the Federal Reserve, and I think you kind of nailed it with the role Alan Greenspan played. After the stock market, you know, the Black Monday collapse in 1987, that really freaked a lot of people out, freaked out Wall Street, freaked out the Fed, and they kind of made a conscious decision to go really far with monetary policy, and then they left it that way for a long time. So, you know, you mentioned, you know, GDP being around 4% in 1999, go back and look at, you know, the 10-year treasury yield, and it was about 6% at some points in 1999. So, you know, we just had a much different, you know, structured economy then. We were at a much different spot, you know, sort of in the long-term debt cycle where we still had, you know, a lot of room to keep ratcheting down interest rates. But at the same time, you know, where we were, he held them down to what, you know, a lot of people would consider to be an artificially low level that drove a lot of money into risk assets, and, you know, that kind of just fueled that tech bubble.
And for those of you that don't understand the relationship between interest rates, again, I think that it's a nuanced topic, meaning that if I can make 4%, let's say, in a U.S. government bond, which is considered to be the least riskiest asset on the face of the earth, so much so that in the financial industry we refer to it as the risk-free rate. If I can make 4% in a U.S. government bond, chances are that I'm going to take less risk in my portfolio, right? Because 4% or even 6%, I don't need to take as much risk because that's accomplishing my financial goals, right? It's achieving my need for retirement income. If those rates drop substantially, if I'm looking at a U.S. 10-year right now, which I think is paying about 0.63, that's obviously not as attractive. So I am more likely to go out further into stocks, right? Think about it. I've got stocks out there like ConocoPhillips or Chevron. I am getting paid a 6% dividend to own them right now. Right now, are those risky stocks? No, not per se, not traditionally in terms of, I mean, you can see big ups and downs, but you're not going to, you know, they've stood the test of time. It's hard to justify sitting there making 0.6% in a U.S. government bond when you can get paid 6% to own a stock just by way of dividend. So the interest rates certainly play a role. We're not saying I think that, and I don't know what your opinion on this, Chase, is. I'd like to hear your thoughts. I think it's sort of like the valuation or the bull bear cases right now. I think that they're way too binary. I don't think that either side of it acknowledges the fact that they could be completely wrong. I think the people out there, the interest rate debate is very much the same to me in the sense that people believe that, look, 0% interest rates can justify any valuation. I think that's laughable. Then you have the people on the other side of it that go, you know, interest rates should have no bearing on valuation. I find that laughable as well. Where do you sit on that?
Yeah, I mean, I tend to agree that it's somewhere in between, and, you know, because if just having rates at zero meant you could, you know, justify enormous spikes in prices, then you'd have a really difficult time explaining European or Japanese equities right now.
Right.
But at the same time, you know, the U.S. is a different market with a lot of different, you know, drivers. And I do think, you know, the rate you can discount, you know, stocks versus being really low, and not to mention just the discount rate, but, you know, what you're valuing against, you know, the alternative for your investment money, you know, being, you know, yielding essentially nothing these days. I do think that does drive a lot of money into equities, you know, which kind of pushes up the risk premium, you know, in the equity market. So like you say, you can't say it has nothing to do with it, and you can't say it's everything, and it means that, you know, price to sales ratios of 30 makes sense. Like that's not the case. But I do think, you know, when you have rates at nothing, and then you are just going to naturally get higher equity prices. So I think there is some explanatory value there, just maybe not as much as a lot of bulls would like to think.
Okay, now the interesting thing moving forward, then, I think everybody knows what happened in the tech bubble. And what's interesting, I think the part about the tech bubble that really gets missed is, for those listeners, I think the majority of our listeners out there will remember Y2K. Well, in preparation for Y2K, the Fed, and I can't remember the mechanism which they do, Chase, you feel free to interrupt me if you remember the mechanism, but they flooded the market with liquidity there at the end of 99. How did they do that? Do you remember?
Well, they definitely lowered, they kept rates pretty low, but they also did some, I think they did some bond buying in the market, kind of the way they do QE now.
Okay. But it wasn't called
QE. But I don't remember well either.
Yeah.
Right.
So anyway, so then after Y2K ended up being kind of an on event, they pulled it back. Well, what happened in 2000, right? That liquidity came out of the market, and then that began the fall off the side of the cliff for the NASDAQ, right? It eventually met its or got to its low, I believe, in 2002, where it was about an 85% drop top to bottom. And that really, to me, something changed there fundamentally in the U.S. economy, because if you think back to that, I do not believe, feel free to correct me if I'm wrong, but I do not believe we have ever achieved another 4% or greater annual growth rate in the United States since then. Is that correct as far as you understand it?
Yeah, definitely. And it really makes perfect sense. So, but yeah, that's definitely the case.
So you never really rebounded. And the last big period of growth, the last time we saw 4% growth, was in the midst of something that everybody acknowledged was an asset bubble. Okay, so
right.
What you can then simultaneously say is that, okay, the growth rate never would have been that high without the bubble. Okay, I'm taking a little bit of a leap there, but I don't think that's unreasonable to come to that conclusion.
Right. Yeah. Definitely.
And so then the next run up that we saw over the next six years, was, again, how did the Fed respond to that NASDAQ collapse? Well, they lowered rates even more, and they began issuing. The Fed didn't do this. U.S. government made some changes in law that really, you know, assisted, but they started blowing another bubble. They forced rates artificially low again. And so then the last period in history where we didn't get back up to 4%, but we had consistent 3% or greater growth, was leading into the 2008, 2009 financial crisis. And we had 3% growth going into that. But again, another situation in which no one would argue it was an asset bubble. So something changed there in that period of time where for the first time in a very long time, certainly since the baby boomers came onto the stage in the late 70s and early 80s, you had an economy that could not get to that magical 3% growth level without an asset bubble. Couldn't do it. Right. And each time it achieved that asset level or that growth rate, it was due to an asset bubble. And then, of course, you come into the financial crisis, 2008, 2009. And, you know, it's a game changer, right? We saw a lot of anomalies historically, right? Real estate falling all over the country at the same time. That had never happened before. You know, the biggest Wall Street banks being on the verge of collapse, needing a blank check from the Fed just to stay solvent. You know, we all know that story. What, Chase, just stopping there, leading into where we're coming, right? We're leading into where we're at today. Why is it, do you think, that we went that, you know, if you look at 99 to 2009, why do you think that decade, what changed? Was it the aging of the baby boomers? Was it slowing down in demographics? Why were we unable to generate growth at a 3% clip or greater without an asset bubble? What do you attribute that to?
To me, it's a couple things. First and foremost, debt levels. The higher your debt level is as a country, especially if they're on, you know, in people's like households' balance sheets, the higher that gets, just it's sort of like a weight you're carrying around. It's like you can just imagine, you know, you're trying to like go on a hike with a rucksack. The more debt you take on, it's just kind of the more weights you're sliding into your rucksack. It just gets harder and harder to grow. And we're at that point, we were, you know, I would say kind of the seventh, eighth inning long-term debt cycle, meaning there's a lot of debt around and it's really weighing down growth. The more debt you have, the less growth you're going to have. That's just, it's about as close to an economic law as you can get. And on top of that, something that kind of hurts growth. So I think a lot of people know, but you know, the U.S. economy is largely driven by consumption. So we really need a lot of consumer demand. We need consumers to have, you know, money to spend for there to be that demand. And I think, as everyone knows, we've had a lot of the way our wealth is distributed in the U.S. has kind of gotten out of whack. And say, it's really been a long-standing trend, but the last 10, 20 years, especially, the rich have gotten a lot richer and the working class has kind of stayed about the same, if not kind of gotten worse. And all of your incremental consumption comes from the working class, comes from the middle class. They're the people that are going to go out and consume if they get more money. So whenever you blew the tech bubble, you know, a lot of people had money sitting around in their 401k, IRA, or, you know, their E-Trade account. So they felt like they could go consume. And likewise, when you had the housing bubble, you know, the working class people felt like they could go take out a loan against their house and go buy some stuff. So those two asset bubbles allowed the people that actually spend money in the economy, largely, you know, the kind of middle class, working class, to go out and spend to where you could actually ratchet that growth up to that 4%, then 3%. But because it is sort of a ratcheting effect, every time it doesn't quite go back as high. So as that wealth distribution has kind of gotten worse and worse, where labor's share of economic output just gets a little bit smaller over time, what that really means is regular people have less and less money to spend. And since how much money regular people spend really drives economic growth, you can see where it gets just really hard. That plus the debt load of the overall economy just gets really hard to grow it at, you know, 4, 5, 6%. It's almost impossible without, you know, just really short-term spikes of stimulus like we got with the recent tax cuts, you know, that allowed for some growth to kind of take off. But all of these measures, whether it's blowing a bubble or, you know, increasing the deficit, you know, all you kind of get is like a few months or maybe a couple years of growing above trend. And then you almost always just kind of have to come back down to that reality of the trend.
Yeah. One of the things that that I think about a lot, and you mentioned the wealth divide, and I want to get into that in the next segment when we're talking about where we're at. So I took some notes. I don't want to forget to address that. But one of the interesting things about where we're at now is that if you look at, you know, it's been happening since the mid 80s. We've talked a lot about it on this program. But one of the interesting things that I think that you see occurring is that I often wonder what that growth rate would have been at in the late 90s, and certainly in the decade from 2000 to 2010, what that growth rate would have looked like had you not had the wind at your back of ever decreasing interest rates, right? Making debt cheaper. Because like you said, you didn't see the growth to drive the asset prices. It was kind of bizarre in a situation that you looked at it and you saw GDP growth, but it wasn't growing productivity. It wasn't growing wages. It was growing debt, right? Debt was filling in the gap, essentially. And, you know, like you pointed out, as that debt kept growing, you kept seeing an incrementally weakening of that economic growth. And then you move into 08, 09, where the answer to that crisis was, you know, we have a liquidity crisis that's spurred really by a debt catastrophe in the economy. And our answer to that on literally every level of the economy was stack on more debt. And then that leads us to the slowest growing decade in U.S. history from 09 till now. So slightly more than a decade. But, you know, and I think you and I have discussed this. The listeners have heard me say it probably 100 times. But, you know, we've got to distinguish between nominal growth and real growth, right? You had a slower nominal growing decade in the Great Depression. But, you know, outside of 36 to 38, where you had that brief flare up of inflation, that was a decade dominated by deflation. So you actually had a higher average annualized growth rate during the Great Depression than you had during the last decade. And that would point, that would marry up well with your thesis, right? About it being mostly a debt scenario. So how, when we're looking at this going forward, especially coming out of 08-09, now you're at a scenario where, and correct me if I'm wrong again, but I think you're going to see now a recession. Well, I mean, you're obviously in a recession, but I think you're going to see a scenario where it's tracking right now. And this is very much the trend where have we ever had another recession where now government balance sheets typically grow, but have we ever had another recession where we see consumer debt and corporate debt growing during a recession?
Yeah, I mean, it's a difficult situation because on one hand, households have actually, since 08, have delevered a lot. And that's because the leverage, you know, the debt to income ratios and stuff for households around 08 was just in the stratosphere. And the U.S. has actually done a decent job of having that kind of get more in line with, you know, it's come down a good bit. If you just look at household debt to GDP, where a lot of the world, it hasn't, it's just gotten worse. Places like Australia, Canada, Northern Europe, they there's not even a blip on the debt levels of their households. But at the same time, the only reason households were able to do that is because the U.S. has just kept running these, you know, enormous government deficits. And in the corporate sphere, you know, corporate debt has just gone basically into the stratosphere. It's kind of the highest we've ever really seen. Corporate debt to GDP levels are, you know, extremely high. And then during this recession, we've had corporations, you know, selling a lot of debt recently. And a lot of it's getting backstopped by the Fed because they're out, you know, buying bonds in the open market, including via ETFs. And so everyone's kind of expanding their debt at the moment, and most of it's going to end up on the Fed's balance sheet, especially, you know, from the corporate and government side. Households have largely been able to, you know, avoid this so far, but that's just because it's all going on the government's balance sheet with all the different measures in the CARES Act, you know, that's putting money into the household's, you know, bank account, you know, whether it's the stimulus checks or, you know, the added unemployment benefits or, you know, the small business measures. So yes, like you're going to have debt problems across the whole economy, but so much of it is going to end up on the government's balance sheet, which is just going to end up on the Federal Reserve's balance sheet.
Yeah. Now, when you say, when we're talking about consumer debt levels on a nominal basis, debt levels are, and I'm trying to pull this up right now. We're currently at what I think 14.3 trillion in consumer debt or something like that.
Nominally it's definitely up, but if you look at it just compared to GDP, it's actually been pretty healthy in the way that it's come down since 08. But again, a lot of that was because it was just outrageously high, and that's why a lot of people thought of that as a balance sheet recession, where the recession was largely driven by the fact that, you know, households had to delever, they had to pay off a lot of debt, and a lot of that was, you know, people losing their homes.
Yeah, that clearly made a big dent. So now going forward over the last 10 years, when you look at the weak growth, like I said, on a real basis, you got the worst economic growth rate of any decade in history. And then one of the things that is just incredible, it's not incredible. I mean, I understand why, but what's fascinating to me is that, you know, the old adage, the economy and the stock market aren't, you know, it's the economy isn't the stock market. It's never rung more true than it has in the last decade. And we can get into where we're at today. You know, we're going to be addressing that here shortly, but you know, it's never been more true than it was over the last decade. It's certainly never been more true at any point over the last decade than it is today. Where you've seen this anemic growth, if not close to zero real growth, yet the S&P is up 330%, the NASDAQ's up 520%, which goes to reinforce this whole concept of lower interest rates certainly playing a part or having an impact on asset prices. And so where does that, what did we witness specifically over the last 10 years? Was was growth, would you attribute that mostly to that balance sheet recession part of it? Would you attribute it to demographics? Would you attribute it to baby boomers retiring? What do you think, birth rates are obviously lower. What do you think is played the biggest factor in how slow that growth has been? Barack Obama is the first president in U.S. history to never have a year of economic growth surpass, get into the 3% level. He never had a single year. And that stat, and this is not an anti-Obama thing. This is talking about the 10-year period or the 8-year period he was in office. That stat includes one-term presidents. So we're not cherry-picking the data. Not only was it 8 years, but no other previous president had gone 4 years without at least 1 year of 3% growth. That, again, that's historic, especially when you look at the underlying performance of the indexes. How do you marry those two things up? And what does that say? What was the driver of that? And it's really odd too, because again, asset prices did not match growth. The other thing that didn't match growth was the price of consumer goods. Look what's happened to the price of cell phones. Look what's happened to the price of cars. Look what's happened to the price of jeans, for crying out loud, right? In 2000, I remember as a kid, even in the 90s, if you were a big spender, you went and got the Levi's silver tabs. Those were like $50. Now you got $300 designer jeans. There's probably a lot more expensive than that. How do you explain that dichotomy, right? Where you've got the prices of these things increased at fairly historic normal levels, if not faster than they had in history. And yet the anemic growth rate, how do we marry those seemingly conflicting data points up?
Sure. And they kind of go hand in hand. And some of this is demographic based, where you think about, the aging population, like the baby boomers today, they were, a giant generation. And for the last, call it 30, 40 years, they've been sort of in their wealth building years where they were doing well. They were able to actually save a lot of money and invest a lot of money. So you had, a big availability of capital all of a sudden for investment. And if you have a lot of capital that kind of is running around trying to find a place to invest, naturally the price of that capital is going to go down, just basic supply and demand. There's a lot of capital coming from baby boomer investors, and there's only so many places it can go. So naturally, the rate that's going to be charged on that investment, that which becomes debt for other people, is going to be low. So, but just kind of in the grand scheme of things, I always think of everything from the standpoint of the long-term debt cycle. And, when that begins, debt levels are low, inflation is high, and you kind of just slowly grow. And at that point, you can actually grow high because you have low debt levels. But as you go, you have a lot of small cycles built into the big cycle. And every small cycle, you get lower and lower interest rates, you get lower and lower inflation, and you get higher and higher debt, just because that's the way the central bank is going to fight each individual small cycle, is by lowering interest rates to try to, help out the economy. So at the end of this whole thing, which is kind of where we are, we're basically at the end of the long-term debt cycle, at least in the ninth inning, you end up where debt levels are incredibly high, inflation levels are incredibly low, and growth is very low. But at the same time, asset prices and wealth inequality tend to be very high. And those obviously kind of go hand in hand. So that's just kind of where we are. And,
yeah,
and what's really important to note is, and we can talk about this for like when we get to the what's to come, is all of those drivers, each of those is kind of starting to change and shift to where, this low growth, low inflation, low interest rate, all this environment is really kind of starting to change, and the demographics are obviously changing.
Well, one of the big questions that I've had, and you and I have not discussed this. I have not formulated an opinion on it as of yet, but it's something that's interesting to me, is that I think you mentioned liquidity, and this goes into the question that, one of the reasons why we decided to do this segment today was, people having an misunderstanding or wanting to understand what we mean by a liquidity-driven market. Well, one of the other things that changed, and I think one of the singular biggest drivers of how you have this complete separation between economic performance and asset prices, lower interest rates being a factor in that, but you also had unprecedented levels of liquidity. And when we talk about liquidity, I think it's very aptly named because money, just like water, flows to the point of least resistance, right? Water is going to flow to the lowest point. Money is typically going to flow to a place where it can be the most productive, or at least historically that has been the trend. But one of the other things that we've noticed is in economies, when you have excess liquidity, that tends to create malinvestment because now you've got essentially more money than you have places for it to flow to. So it you know, like overflowing a glass, right? Liquidity or the water ends up on the kitchen counter as opposed to in your mouth or in your cup, right? So the other really interesting thing is that the Fed launched quantitative easing. I still remember the day it was announced. I sat there and I felt like an idiot because my first question was, what is quantitative easing and why have I never heard of this? Well, you know, looking back in history, I think the term was coined by Bernanke only like a year and a half or 2 years prior to that. Maybe it was as early as 2002, but nobody was really familiar with that term. So would it be fair then to say... And then you also had massive deficits, record deficits run by the government over the last 10 years to the point where, you know, if you have a $1 trillion deficit now, you know, that's obscene. But if you got an $800 billion to a $1 trillion deficit, we've obviously seen a lot worse, which is pretty wild. But in some ways, could you say the Federal Reserve and the U.S. government in combination of quantitative easing, which is, and again, what we mean by that is the Federal Reserve pushes a button. They can create currency out of thin air. They fill an account with money. They basically then take that money. I mean, it's bank reserves, but just to put it in layman's terms, they take that money and they buy government bonds. So they are replacing bonds with cash, right? And now that cash sits on the bat. We don't want to get into this whole debate, but essentially, right, there's people that make the, you know, that try to make the argument that it has no impact. Well, if it has no impact, why do they do it? So you've got this inflow of capital that is being created out of thin air, pumping into banks, which are the hub of financial markets. And then you've got government deficits. Do you think that does a lot to explain how we had this giant decade-long dichotomy between unusually record low real growth and yet record asset performance?
Yeah, I mean, I think it definitely plays a role. Part of it's just a confidence game, but part of it is real where, you know, even if all that happened from the Federal Reserve buying bonds was that they, you know, lowered rates some and people even argue that. I think that is true. I think the Federal Reserve definitely lowers interest rates when they go out and buy a lot of bonds with printed money. And the lower the interest rate gets on safe assets, the more risk you have to take to make the same return. Especially, you know, if you're a really large institution, if you're managing a pension or maybe an endowment or a sovereign wealth fund, you know, making 1% is just not going to be very interesting to you. There's really no point in even doing that. So, you know, maybe you used to hold some treasuries when they were paying you 5%, but now that they're paying you half of 1%, you may as well go out on the, you know, on the risk curve, buy something more risky, buy some, you know, high yield debt or some sovereign debt from a kind of a scarier part of the world that's riskier. You know, that's part of the reason we saw Argentine 100-year bonds get a giant bid before they, you know, went bankrupt for the millionth time is because, you know, you have to chase, you know, riskier stuff to just make the same return you used to make in the risk-free stuff. So yeah, definitely, you know, whenever you warp the way investors are going to see risk based on the way it's priced, of course, they're going to have to go to riskier corners of the investment universe to get returns. And some people don't really have a choice, you know. If you're managing a pension and you have a schedule where you have to pay out to your employees that were vested in that pension, like you don't really have a choice to say, hey, sorry, like we're just not going to pay you. Like at the end of the day, you're going to go out and you're going to chase that risk, whether it's, you know, venture capital or private equity, or, you know, you're going to go buy some WeWork debt, you know, because it pays well. Like that's just kind of how it works for those people if they have a mandate to make a certain amount. So I definitely think, you know, equities and you know, corporate credit in the U.S. is higher than it would have been if interest rates were allowed to kind of find their own natural level.
Yeah, agreed. Okay, so now I think hopefully that's cleared some things up about where we've come from, right? So to summarize, I think that, you know, the easiest way to look at this is for a variety of different reasons, you had decelerating growth or growth that really was stagnant. And then you had a combination between interest rate policy and injections of liquidity and everything that makes up for, you know, a lack of economic demand. And like you said, you've got, you know, the supply and demand issues with, you know, bonds and stocks and institutional investors. And you get to this point where you see this record run in, and there really is nothing else to compare it to. I mean, I think that's something that you and I can agree on, where you've seen the market certainly over 2 to 3 year periods in the past, maybe even four, where the market is really, you know, is seemingly separated from economic reality. But there really is no comp to what we've witnessed in the last decade. And I think the easiest way, and again, before we move on to the where we're at today, I think one of the easiest ways to see that, right, is by looking at the disparity of wealth, right? The wealth divide, or so it's called.
Right.
If you see a record wealth divide in an environment where assets are going way up, you know inherently that their economies are driven by the middle class, unequivocally. That it's why China's actively trying to build their middle class. Because by definition, your middle class makes up the, you know, you want it to anyway, to make up the majority of your population. So when the middle class is continually falling behind, you know, in an environment like that, and this is one of the things that I have such an issue with the Fed, and I think the Fed is needed. I'm a believer in having a lender of last resort. I think the dual mandate is a disaster, meaning that the Fed's mandate originally was price stability. So essentially aimed at the price of the currency, right? Keeping the dollar stable, avoiding hyperinflation, avoiding massive deflation, but trying to keep the price of the dollar stable, which makes a ton of sense, and being a lender of last resort. And then they added the dual mandate, which is full employment. And to me, that's where they went off the rails, because in the name of full employment, we can really do anything, right? I mean, obviously, we can even violate the Federal Reserve Act and backstop the entire corporate bond market, which is now what they've done. But the interesting thing to me is it, you know, the Fed to me seems like a guy that's, you know, they've dug a hole, right? And then they go over to dig another hole, and every shovel load of the new hole is getting thrown into the other hole, right? So they're filling that one up as fast as they're digging the new one, and they're never making any progress, because as they try to stave off, and to their credit, right, I think the intentions are there. I think the road to hell is paved with good intentions, but they're trying to stave off or shorten the severity of recessions. But I think inadvertently what they end up doing, and again, it proves, you know, this is in the data, that you no longer need, right? It was kind of, you have this self-balancing ecosystem that the better the middle class did, the more things they would buy, therefore the more wealth that was generated, therefore wages went up, right? It was this self-balancing system. Then you have the Fed jump in, and the maestro takes the helm, and they begin essentially targeting liquidity levels and by default asset prices, although you'll never get them to admit that. And you start seeing the ability for wealth to be created and asset prices to rise to stratospheric levels without the growth of the middle class. So do you think it's fair to say that in some ways the Fed crowded out the middle class, that they made middle class progress, that they anesthetized that self-balancing mechanism in the economy?
Yeah, just absolutely. There's no question, you know, the Federal Reserve wanted asset prices to move higher, and the people that own assets, you know, are the wealthy. So, I mean, by definition, every time you make asset prices move higher, you're making the wealth of the wealthy go higher. So, but I would say it's not just the Fed. It's a combination of Fed and just kind of government policy as a whole. And the way government treats capital versus labor is just like, you know, the economy itself is very cyclical. You know, it's sort of like a 40-year cycle probably versus the overall economy, which runs as like about an 80-year cycle for long-term debt cycle. But you go through cycles where, you know, capital is really treated well and labor is sort of suppressed. And then that flips where on its head. So like you think about, you know, Teddy Roosevelt going after, you know, all the trust busting and helping out labor unions. And he really helped labor, you know, kind of gain a foothold versus capital. And then that kind of really stayed in place for a long time. You could argue all the way until about, you know, the early 80s under, you know, the kind of the Reagan era, where it kind of shifted back. It became more like shareholder capitalism, where you kind of see a lot less going after monopolies and duopolies and things like that. And you know, you can just look at any chart of labor share of GDP, and it's kind of, you know, it's gone down a lot, and corporate profits have gone up a lot. I mean, corporations have been able to keep way more of their money. So it's a combination of that. You know, if you stop going after corporate concentration and you allow, you know, these mergers and acquisitions to turn into just like a few giant companies where they have extreme efficiency, you know, it's easy for them to kind of suppress wages and suppress labor in other ways. And that has major consequences, as does the wealth disparity. And like you say, it is very self-reinforcing. The more money that kind of concentrates at the top, whether it's corporate or, you know, personal, it just has a tendency to stay there. You look at all the you know, share buybacks in the last few years. And a lot of that is, if you think about it, you know, the middle class is the one out there spending money. Well, if the middle class doesn't have money to spend, if you're running a big corporation, you probably don't have anything to invest in, because no one's going to buy incremental production. So you take all your profits in and you look at them and think, well, should I, you know, buy, you know, build on a new wing to my, you know, factory? And you think, well, no one's really going to buy that, because whether you know it or not, the middle class doesn't have the money to buy it. So instead of reinvesting more in your business, maybe you just buy back some shares or pay out a giant dividend, and that giant dividend or those share buybacks, you know, that's going to the people holding your equity. And the people holding your equity are already wealthy. So this whole thing is like very self-reinforcing loop. And this has happened over and over in history. And it tends to, it'll just feed on itself and get more extreme until, you know, we end up with a government that a lot of your listeners aren't going to want to, you know, to face, but probably end up with a, you know, left populist type government where they really go after big business and they really do, you know, what we would consider extreme policy to help out the working class. But if you just look at it from a, you know, a non-political standpoint, it is just a natural cycle. It's a natural function of the way this kind of always has worked and always will work. And we're sort of due for, you know, a situation where somebody has to do something, whether it's, you know, policy to go after antitrust and kind of break up monopolies, or it's, you know, on the monetary side where,
right,
where debtors actually start doing better than creditors, and that usually comes with inflation. So the way out of this, and it will be painful for everyone, but will likely be with some extreme government decisions and also some inflation to kind of help out those debt levels.
Yeah, that's one of the issues that I have. And I understand that they're trying to help, but with again, the road to hell is paved with good intentions. The older I get and the longer I do this for a living, and look, people are going to call this hyperbolic. That's fine. You probably saw an interview recently with Hugh Hendry, a guy that I really respect. I think Hugh's a brilliant guy. And he was taking the back of the Fed. And he was saying that he thought they did a pretty good job. And I understand where Hugh's coming from. In terms of generating GDP and keeping unemployment low, I would agree with him. Where I disagree with him, and in my opinion, where I look at the Fed, and again, this is hyperbolic in nature, but it's just the way that I view things, so you can feel free to disagree. I think they're public enemy number one. I don't think it's by intention, but I think that they are completely out of control. I also think that I think the easiest way to rein this in, and this is the difficult part about where we're currently at, is that there's and moving now into where we're currently at, there is no easy way out. right? So the guys like me that sit there and go, this wealth inequality thing, one of the easiest ways you could fix this problem is just stop the Fed. Right. Just stop them, because then these U.S. corporations wouldn't be able to pull the shenanigans they're pulling, because they wouldn't have a consumer to buy their goods. Right. I think a lot you'd bring back in that self-balancing aspect of the economy. And look, it's never one thing. So I'm not saying it's that simple, but I think that would take a big that would take a big step in fixing that problem, or at least addressing it to some degree. And I think they're public enemy number one. I mean, And it's easy to just point out, is look, as the Fed has gotten increasingly involved, right, wages have stagnated and the wealth disparity has gone to record levels. So to me, I look at that and go, okay, any good that they claim to have done sort of gets trumped. And the other side of it is the other issue I have is that, are recessions bad? Yes, they're not fun. Right. But are they an existential threat? No, they're a normal part. They're a self-cleansing mechanism of free markets. Where I look at the Fed, and if you look at disasters in history, right, think of the French Revolution, and there's many, many more. The Great Depression, it was a big factor, not a singular factor, but a big factor. Wealth disparity is one of the most troubling things you can see historically. It never points to good things. It points to civil unrest. It points to government overthrow. Like you mentioned, it usually leads the way or paves the road for massive inflation and currency devaluation. So I look at I feel like the Fed has made a deal with the devil, in the sense, yeah, to stave off recessions, which aren't pleasant and are politically inconvenient, we've ushered in the potential and the growing metastatization. There's a five-letter word for, or $10 word for you, right, of an existential threat, right? This growing wealth divide. And look, you look at the situation in Minnesota going on currently, and I'm not blaming that on the Fed, so I'm not going off rail here. But if you continue to see 15 to 20% unemployment in stock markets that are making new record highs every single day, at some point that's not going to go over well, right? At some point people are going to get ticked. And you're ushering, are we doing that? Would you agree with me that you think that, and again, if you think I'm too hyperbolic, feel free to say it. But would you agree with the assessment that you think they're public enemy number one, and that they are muting that self-balancing force? And if they left well enough alone, it wouldn't be fun. We'd have a very nasty recession, possibly even a depression of sorts. I don't think it'd last 10 years because the banking system wouldn't collapse. But, I think it would be better than the alternative. What are your thoughts?
So this is definitely very complex. I think, a lot of people that tend to be free market types, laissez-faire types, whether libertarian or just, more like conservative types, a lot of times they see a lot of benefit in recessions. And I do too. I think recessions are a very natural function. I think people going out of business, I think bankruptcy, I think failure is all just incredibly important feedback in any system. Any natural system, any man-made system, you have to have that to understand what's working, what's not. There's no other way to efficiently allocate capital than other than to have some failure. So I think that is incredibly important. But what I will say on the other side of that is, think about Great Depression and other points historically where whenever we have a bust, we allow essentially the working class, the middle class, to just get annihilated with unemployment. And I do think that you don't have to do that. I think there are ways to, kind of backstop the economy enough to keep employment, at least at a level where it doesn't become self-reinforcing and break down into a depression that hurts an entire generation of regular people. So I think there's sort of a middle ground there. But I think so. You called the Fed public enemy number one. In my opinion, Congress is just as
good point.
is just as on the hook, and going forward they will be more so. The Fed's kind of they can't really lower rates anymore. At this point they really depend on fiscal policy to make anything work.
Okay, I agree with you, and I don't mean to interrupt you, but one of the issues, sure, I've got is if they would leave well enough alone rather than this dual mandate BS. they're taking the pressure off Congress to act. Congress doesn't need to act when these morons are pumping $5-7 trillion into the economy, because they're the anesthetizing agent. They take the pressure off Congress. So then I sit there and listen to Jay Powell. Well, you know, Congress has really got to get there. And it's like, hey, Jay, if you didn't try to fix everything with printed money, you'd make them do their bloody job.
Totally. Yeah, 100% agree with that. I think Congress has sort of handed over a chunk of their authority to the executive branch, a chunk of it to the Federal Reserve, and they've kind of just been coasting for about 30 years. But moving forward, they're definitely going to have to do more. And, during the Obama years, where the economy was really just kind of flat and slow, Congress, during the Tea Party years, like, they really brought spending back, and they stopped, investing then. And that kind of was a part of us growing slowly. Like, it, helped to keep the deficit, low-ish, but at the same time, it hurt growth, and it made the Fed, have to go in and do more. The Fed was the only game in town for any sort of stimulative measures, for about a decade. But like you say, if the Fed just said, hey, like, yeah, cool, we're not, just going to go out and buy a bunch of corporate bonds and every treasury ever, like, yes, like, policymakers would have to take this much more seriously and would have to do something, and if you think corporate concentration is a problem, and I do, I think it genuinely hurts the economy. If the Fed stopped, printing all this money, Congress might have to actually take a hard look at something like that, but they don't, because they've always had the Fed there to kind of keep the economy going with nothing but monetary policy.
Yeah. And it's, well, obviously, like I said, I call them public enemy number one, so I didn't really mince words. It's like listening to kids fighting over a toy, right? Congress is griping about this. The Fed's going, well, if Congress would act, you sit there and go, if you left well enough alone, Congress would have to act, right? You've taken the weight off their shoulders. And I honestly think at this point, I think that a guy like Jerome Powell, who I'm sure has good intentions, I think at this point it's as much about keeping the egg off their face, meaning that, he's got no desire to be. Who was the head of the – was it Irving Fisher was the head of the Fed during the Great Depression? Is that – no, I'm blanking out right now. That's not right. Or I'm thinking of Morgenthau, but he was the head of the Treasury at that time. I wasn't Morgan. Anyway, they're all – I think that they're paranoid about being that. Right. Which is, to me, the only explanation. And I'm getting off tangent a little bit, but a perfect example of this to me is the backstopping of the corporate bond market. I still have not heard a cogent reason for why they had to do that, why they had to violate Federal Reserve. Well, because bond price, let them fall, for God's sakes. To me, the preservation of a free market is far more important than the short-term inconvenience of falling prices. What do you have an explanation? And if you do, I'm all ears. What is the justification for, once again, talk about doing Congress's job for them. What is the justification for the unlawful violation of the Federal Reserve Act to backstop the corporate bond market?
I mean, at the end of the day, they were just trying to keep the spreads reasonably tight, and they were trying to keep they didn't want to have a lot of companies all going out of business all at one time and just massive layoffs of labor. That's the only thing I can think of. But
how would the bond market?
I agree. At the end of the day,
how would the bond if you've got company X and all of a sudden their bonds are trading at at $80, right? 20% off par. Well, how does that increase? I fail to see the transmission. To me, and look, again, I lie somewhere in the middle, because believe it or not, there are people out there that hate the Fed even worse than I do. But, and I don't hate them. I just, when I say public enemy number one, I don't wish violence on these guys. I don't think they're bad people. I just think that they're incredibly short-sighted. And I think that they are way overconfident in their own abilities and their own understanding of things. And I think the mess that I don't think we could have gotten in this big a mess without them. But to me, I've looked at the whole scenario. I can't come to any conclusion other than the fact that I honestly feel like the backstopping of the corporate bond market was nothing more than just trying to bail out hedge funds and institutions. It's the only thing that makes any sense to me. Do you think there's any validity to that?
Yeah, I mean, I definitely think it's part of it. And it wasn't, it's not just there. They've done a lot to whether, you know, a lot of their bond buying and just rate moves, you know, because I think a lot of people don't realize how many treasuries are owned by hedge funds, and they, you know, they do it on such huge leverage because that's the only way to make money in treasuries at these rates. But, and a lot of what the Fed did, you know, kind of in March, so with some of these emergency measures, was to bail out the hedge funds that, you know, were going to get just crushed because they owned so many treasuries on margin. You know, they just borrow a bunch of money that, and then they throw it all into wildly over-leveraged positions in treasuries. So when treasuries started backing up, going the wrong way, like a lot of those guys were going to blow up. So, you know, you just don't get near as much Main Street support as you get Wall Street support, and that, and again, just all kind of funnels itself right back into
The wealth
all the same
disparity.
problems of the inequality, right? It's the unintended consequences from, well, we hope at least there are unintended consequences from Fed policy. It does, you know, it really does not help that situation at all.
Well, no.
And granted, they have like ready-made channels to help Wall Street. And that does make sense. Whereas obviously, like, they don't have our bank account where they can throw some printed money into it. So I do understand, you know, the mechanisms aren't there, but at the same time, I don't think they examine the unintended consequences of what they're doing and going to do
I don't know.
nearly
I
enough.
don't know that they acknowledge them. I mean, I've never even heard them acknowledge them. You know, the way they passed the buck to Congress, what did they? Somebody asked Powell recently about the widening wealth disparity, and he literally said, "Look, we have nothing to do with that. You got to talk to Congress." And my jaw just hit the. I don't ex I wouldn't expect him to say anything else. I would have expected somebody with his level of intelligence to give a little more nuanced answer than that. But my jaw just dropped open because I sat there and I went, okay, you are either completely dishonest or you are the most intellectually vapid individual I've ever. I mean, you have nothing to do with it. For instance, who's out there bailing out, right? The guy making 70 grand a year working 80 hours a week running his restaurant, but you're going to bail out Citadel and Bridgewater? It's
Right.
disgusting to me. If they get caught offsides because they're deploying leverage, let them burn, right? And if the Fed needs to keep the market orderly, step in there and buy the treasuries for them, but do it in such a way that you don't backstop the entire market. And if they got caught
Yeah, make it take a
offsides,
loss on it.
make them take a bloody loss for God's sake. I just, it, you know, and then you've got to sit there and then look at the reality. And I'm channeling my inner Rudy Havenstein here. Well, I mean, look, where do all these guys go to work, right? Ben Bernanke's getting paid what, $2.5 million, $3 million a year by Citadel? I mean, you can't convince me that doesn't have some sway. What is Ben, the guy that says he's the issues in subprime are contained, right? As was that late 2005, middle of 2006 when he said that, right? The issues
Yeah,
in
it's about
subprime.
06.
Yeah, the issues in subprime are contained. What expertise is Ken Griffin paying him at Citadel for three? What is it? It's either, I said 2.5. I think maybe it's as high as 4 million. What justifies that paycheck other than the access, right? Like,
Yeah, it's just access. Everyone knows that. Same as the retired generals going to work for the big defense firms. Like
Raytheon and.
it's who you know. Yeah.
Yeah, no, it's just disgusting to me. And the Fed perpetuates that. And then, like I said, meanwhile, the restaurant worker just saw his entire life's work wiped out. And Ken Griffin, who's worth $15 billion or whatever it is, he gets bailed out because the Fed doesn't want him to take a loss. It just, you know, and that to me, again, I'm in the financial industry. I've been lucky enough to you know, not have on, you know, not worry about unemployment. You know, so. Again, people might go, well, it's easy for you to say, Zach, you know, you're part of the problem. We're a registered investment advisor. That's not a, it's, we're not a multi-billion-dollar hedge fund. Big difference. We sure as heck can't afford to hire an ex-head of the FOMC for 4 million a year. So it's a very different animal. You know, I jokingly said on Twitter, I don't know if you saw this, but I said, my new financial goal is to get big enough to be bailed out, to be too big to fail, right? Because, I mean, you talk about talk about gold, right? You run your leverage, you run your balance sheet to the bloody moon. Anytime there's a problem, here comes Powell or Bernanke or Yellen riding to the rescue, bailing you out. It's just disgusting. So, okay, so that leads us in. We're talking about where we are today, but now looking at market conditions, because, and I said this before you came on, everybody listening to the show today understands my opinion. I've made it apparently abundantly clear. I think that where you're at right now, on a fundamental level, I could not be more bearish. On a technical level, it looks extraordinarily bullish to me. And I've been telling our listeners, hey, I think that you gotta, until we cross that 2930 level, which marked that 61.8% retracement of the bottom, and until you cross the 200-day moving average, you gotta play defensively, because you know every single time in history when you've seen an event like that, that's a bear market rally. You're not big time above both those levels, but you're above them, and you've held above them now on the 200-day for 3 days in a row, I want to say. I mean, it looks like Buzz Lightyear market's back on to infinity and beyond. I mean, it looks like, you know, if there was bad news that could disrupt this market run, you've had it. I mean, it just doesn't care. How do we rationalize this? And I want to make this very clear to investors. I hate the bull bear argument that's currently going on right now. I hate it. And the reason why I hate it is because it degenerates down into, in my opinion, for the most part, into this ridiculous argument between fundamentals. Okay. The bulls arguing that there's hope and there's green shoots, which is just literally there is no data. The data points could not be worse. They've never been worse. So just that to me is fanciful, right? Child bedtime story nonsense. And just on a factual level, and you can feel free to disagree with me, but, equally as frustrating as the bears go, well, look at the fundamentals. This has to collapse. And I'm sitting there going, A, where have you been for the past decade? B, yes, we all know that the fundamentals are trash, at least the people that aren't, you know, the Jim Cramers of the world that just, you know, think that higher prices are manifest destiny or something like that. But, you know, I think that the rational people in between sit there and go, you know, and I know based on our conversations that you'd agree with me that, yeah, the fundamentals are a bloody disaster, right? You've got the most expensive stock market and basically record price levels on markets across the board in the greatest economic shock in U.S. history. Yet that's counterbalanced by the Fed going all in, including breaking the law, which we referenced earlier, violating the terms of the Federal Reserve Act. The U.S. government running $6 to $7 trillion deficits this year alone. And people are going to go, well, the deficit's only $4 trillion. Okay. They've got another $2 to $3 trillion stimulus package on the deck. And I think that's, again, you can feel free to disagree with me. The deficit and the Fed balance sheet is just going higher, right? I mean, incessantly. Just wouldn't you say just bake that into the cake? They can't pull back at this point, can they?
No. And so just, if it ends this decade anywhere under $50 trillion, I would be shocked. So it's just going to naturally just keep moving higher and higher. It literally has to.
Yeah, more debt begets more debt, and they're just going to keep playing this game. And you know, and again, not sitting there saying, oh, we're right or anything like that. But for those that have been listening to the show from the beginning, that's why we've been saying this. We've been saying, look, they are going to do this. They are going to pursue this policy until something breaks. They are going to print until they can't print anymore. They literally are going to keep compounding the debt until they can't, until something takes the keys away from them. As long as they can, be prepared. Every single problem, no matter how minuscule it is, they will continue to treat it with the, you know, it's, I made another tweet earlier where I was equating federal government and Federal Reserve policy to antibiotics, right? Meaning that, I don't know, you don't have a kid yet, so you haven't realized this. If you take your kid in to see the doctor, with any type of ailment, it is shocking to me how often they will dole out, as a precautionary measure, antibiotics, right? For everything, just passing out antibiotics, antibiotics, antibiotics. And we know through science and time that can be incredibly damaging to your system, and it also retards your own immune system, and it creates a whole host of other problems. You know, personally, I think it contributes to higher cancer rates, right? Cancer is just a malfunctioning of your immune system and antibiotics suppress it. So, you know, I think there's a link there. But I equate it to antibiotics because literally there is no problem that they don't run into where, you know, it's like the Federal Reserve and the federal government as well. They're a hammer and everything they see in the world is a nail, which is no matter what the problem, we're just going to throw money at it. We're going to throw money at it. And now you see this. To me, what I've been describing to our clients is, look, you got a clean break, right? Like to a magnitude we've never seen before, where you have a clean break of, you know, stratospheric record asset prices with an economic backdrop that literally has never been worse. How do we explain that? What parts of what I just said do you disagree with? How about including how I was analyzing the bear bull debate, how I felt like they were really missing the point as far as, you know, the bulls. I don't know what the bulls are talking about fundamentally. You know, I hear them all the time sitting there. It was really funny. I listened to a podcast from another investment firm the other day, and I think I mentioned this to you, but the argument was, hey, there's a lot of fear out there, and fear is great for stocks. You know, you got to buy that fear, man. This is an opportunity. And I literally started laughing out loud because I went, hey, guys, the point wasn't to buy fear. The point is that traditionally fear equates to lower asset prices, right? So I think they're kind of putting the cart before the horse there. How do you assess this current situation and what I was saying as far as the bull bear debate, the total separation between asset prices and fundamentals? And the reason, Chase, just so you know, and I'm going on here. One of the reasons I wanted the listeners to hear your take on this, and I don't know, you and I didn't discuss this before coming on the air. One of the reasons that I really wanted to have this conversation with you is you are a guy that pays attention to the fundamentals, but they don't necessarily drive your outlook. You're more of a macro guy and also more of a technician. So do you disagree with me about this fundamental disconnect on the valuation side? Kind of just address everything I was just going on there about for far too long.
Sure. So, and there's a lot of moving parts here. I'll just kind of break them apart and just tell you how I feel about each one. As far as the fundamentals and the bull bear debate goes, I think the level of international of intellectual gymnastics it would take to justify, you know, what the market's doing based on the actual economy is just, it's kind of absurd. Like I think you know usually, you know, financial media or, you know, people selling something can find a way to wrap a story around the market that makes some sense. I just don't think we're in one of those. You know, Q2, the real-time estimate from the New York Fed for Q2 GDP is negative 35%. That's not, you know, that's not a situation where you would expect stocks to be ripping, going up every day. So I think the argument that, you know, the fundamentals in the economy justify it, obviously that's not true. You know, for a long time, I've viewed liquidity as being more important than earnings. And like we talked about earlier, it's clearly never been more true. But at the same time, I've been able to sidestep a lot of these kinds of things in the past because I took that view. And this time the economy was so bad that I let myself kind of go closer to fundamentals than I normally do. And obviously all it's done is cost me money because we've gone up. But but I think what's really important moving forward is I think the combination of what the Fed has done and what Congress has done has been a very, very effective Band-Aid. And that has allowed the market to go higher. If you look at so personal income is actually up, not down, which when you think about how many people have lost their jobs, is pretty remarkable. And you know, that's an aggregate. There's a lot of people that whose income, you know, is not going up and they've been hurt by this, obviously. But on aggregate, because you poured so much money on the low end of the spectrum, people that were making more money on unemployment than they were working, stuff like that, you know, that's a very effective short term, you know, fix. And that program, so almost all of these programs that, you know, were shoveling a lot of money into the hole we were digging, they end this summer. And at the moment, we just don't really know what Congress is going to do. Are they going to extend some of these programs or are they going to modify them? Are they just going to let them run off? So really what happens in DC is going to, I think, you know, that's really going to tell you what's going to happen with markets the rest of the year. Obviously, the Fed will play its important role.
Chase, let me interrupt you for a second. But what do you think the chances are they pull back on the reins? You and I both know they can't. I think it's baked in.
I think they could. But so obviously it's an election year, so they're not going to go too far. But I could see some people, especially people that have, you know, strong ideological, you know, ties to not having really high deficits. There's probably two of those left in the world, but I think maybe one of them is in Congress. So I could see them letting some stuff run off and see how the economy reacts. But obviously, if the economy doesn't like it and, you know, the S&P is all of a sudden down 20% again, like, of course, they'll push everything through and, you know, we'd probably be right back where we are now. But I think as far as the path for how we, you know, navigate the rest of this year, a lot of it's going to come down to what Congress does. And I think we've all grown very used to watching the Fed to try and figure out what the market's going to do. Sadly, macro has been just basically watching the Fed and trading based on that for the last 20 years. I think even more unfortunately, it's going to kind of turn more into like, what is Congress doing? What's happening with fiscal spending? You know, and as well as policy measures that, you know, are more about, you know, labor and things like that. But so I think that's going to move markets more moving forward. But where we're at now, I mean, clearly the market is expensive based on essentially anything you can base it on. It's expensive, but at the end of the long-term debt cycle where you have radical policy, and you know, and most times if you have radical policy, inflation would spike and you'd have to stop the radical policy. We're at a spot where that it doesn't really work that way at the moment. So they can do a lot of really radical stuff and get away with it, you know, for months, if not even years. So, you know, you look at that incentive structure, you realize, oh, well, that means they're going to do all they can get away with. And it'll have, you know, really big consequences before you get that inflation spike that kind of changes the game and changes everyone's incentive structure and their reaction function.
So what do you think that portends for the traditional value approach? I mean, you've seen Buffett, you know, who's, he must pay attention to technicals on some level. He certainly doesn't act on them. Does that mean this is the death of value investing? I mean, or do fundamentals eventually win out? Or, you know, where are we at? You know, even you take a guy like David Tepper, who I think, you know, takes both into consideration. At least it seems like he takes values and technicals into consideration. You know, he's saying that he's got 20% equity exposure. Are we looking at a new paradigm? Is a 30 PE on the S&P ratio or on the S&P 500, is that going to be the new normal? Where does that take us from here? I mean, is it to infinity and beyond? Could we see a 5,000-6,000 S&P in the next year and a half to 2 years? I mean, where does that leave us? Does that just not matter anymore? Should we go out and buy, you know, Tesla and Shopify? I mean, where does that leave us?
You know, a lot of it depends on and policy, and it depends on inflation. You know, like these high growth tech stocks that, you know, their correlation to rates moving lower is like more intense than it is for value. So,
yeah,
you know, no inflation and low rates is just like rocket fuel to a lot of these like platform companies, tech companies, whereas it just doesn't have the same effect for people making real stuff. Which, you know, a lot of value tends to be people making real stuff. It's a lot of cyclical sectors. It's a lot of sectors that deal in commodities that have more overhead. And I think, you know, if you get a shift to where you, and eventually we will, I think it'll happen this decade where inflation starts to make a comeback. I think, you know, and rates have to eventually, you know, interest rates from the Federal Reserve have to eventually start moving higher. You know, that's where that you might start seeing that shift. So things could get way more painful for value between now and then. But I think, do I think value investing is dead? The answer to that's no. Now, do value investors have to maybe look at it differently than they have in the past? Have some things actually changed forever because of technology? And sure, maybe. But yeah, like when you talk about a 30 PE, could that be the new normal? Like, I think absolutely yes. I think Wow. I think we could get overvalued on a level that is really difficult to even comprehend. And I think it could last, you know, it could last as long as inflation not being a big problem lasts, because interest rates are just going to keep going lower. I think, you know, treasury bonds have been, you know, an anchor for everyone's portfolio for at least a generation. And as we move forward, it's become more and more obvious that there's just no point in holding something that's paying you nothing to hold it and isn't going to go up in value. And quite, you know, and if not for the Fed backstopping, it would go down in value. So, you know, as people move their money out of treasuries, where are they going to put them? You know, some of that's going to spill over into gold, but a lot of it's going to spill into equities.
Well, and there is something that we like to refer to as a bond replacement strategy. You know, we've been addressing this problem, Chase, for quite a while now. So that is certainly the issue. Now, certainly the case anyway, that valuations continue to get more obscene. And I will tell you this, you know, although we do it very differently with our algorithmic portfolio that's got a tremendous defense built into it, it was down. For regulatory reasons, I can't cite the exact performance because you got to get into how you qualify and all that kind of stuff. But that momentum algorithm portfolio, that momentum-based portfolio that we have, blew the doors off the S&P last year, and they're at the bottom. When the market was down 36, it was down, you know, in the low single digits. It did a phenomenal job. But I will admit, the reason that we added that portfolio to our repertoire was because of this issue, sitting there saying, look, if, you know, we're doing the discipline thing, we're buying companies with value, but this disparity between the value performance and growth performance has been so large and lasted so long that one of our fears was, we've got to do it in a way that protects principal. Because when this ends, and it will, when this ends, you know, that's the other thing. I was sitting there having a conversation with somebody the other night. I economic collapses and drops and all that kind of stuff, you're never going to mute that out of the system. But, you know, for a long time, when you looked at the Federal Reserve and you looked at the U.S. government, under normal circumstances, you kind of scratched a Great Depression, you know, 85% drop on the Dow is a thing of yesteryear, right? Under the current construction of the market, I just don't think that could happen. I suppose it's possible, but
it won't be allowed to.
Yeah, no, I think the Fed would step in and buy stocks if they had to. I mean, they absolutely would. I think all the people go, they wouldn't buy stocks. It's like the same. You and I had this conversation yesterday. It's the same people that were telling me I was nuts for saying they were going to buy corporates. I don't think those people are paying attention to current events, right? They will do. And then if you also believe the whole adage, the Fed doesn't care about the market, I'm more convinced every single day that that's the single data point that they're the most obsessed with. Because their actions are so aimed at asset prices. It's almost become, a singular focus of theirs. But anyway, looking at that whole scenario about where they're at, and you and I have addressed this already, you know, they're not going to stop. They're not going to quit. But at some point, I think it ushers in the possibility of creating the soil, creating the environment that could produce a depressionary-like drop in markets, right? Like, you know, the path that we're on is eerily similar to Japan in the late 80s. And we've been saying that for a while. And, you know, look, I love being an American. It's the best place on earth. I wouldn't want to be anywhere else. But I think Americans are, unfortunately, there's this attitude like it's been so good here for so long that they act as if they're untouchable, that those things couldn't happen here. And I think that, look, you're not close to the Japanese valuations yet. But considering the economic environment and the record valuations on indexes across the board, I think that this period right now is the closest we've been to a Japanese type scenario in 89, where I think the CAPE ratio reached like 100 on Japanese stocks. And this is one of the reasons we've said, hey, guys, are the fundamentals trash? Yeah. But, you know, I wouldn't be surprised, I that probably wouldn't be true. I mean, it would be shocking. But, you know, before this is over, I wouldn't rule out the potential, for instance, for the S&P reaching 7,000-8,000. Do you think that those comparisons between us and Japan of the late 80s, you think that's fair?
Yeah, so like last time I was on your show, and I think even another time, I mentioned the Japan Cape ratio, because it's always made clear to me, like, you know, where we're at now seems crazy, but where you can go is just so much crazier than where we're at.
Right.
And you know, we have all the conditions that would kind of create something like that. So I definitely think evaluations could just be significantly, you know, less, like, even more detached from economic reality. You know, you can just get absurd overvaluation in stocks, you know, 7,000-8,000, like you talked about, 10,000. I don't know what it is, but yeah, of course it's very possible. And, you know, you kind of mentioned there could be that possibility of a really ugly collapse, you know, after you get to that. And while I think that's true, I personally think the collapse will happen on a real basis and not a nominal basis. I think, you know, obviously Japan never had an inflationary event after their crisis. They've just been in a grinding, you know, 20-year deflation, or, you know, just lack of inflation, where
30.
Everyone is slowly, yeah, just slowly delevered, you know, since 89. And I don't think we'll take the slow, painful deleveraging process. And I think America's different, where we couldn't do that without having some employment problems and political problems. Whereas, you know, you're not going to get a populist, you know, wave come in a place like Japan. But you would hear. So if you allow for, you know, a big problem in the labor market, which you would if you got a deflationary scenario, you know, the consequences of that are too bad. So I think we'll choose the inflationary scenario, which means on a real basis, yes, you're going to lose on a real basis in stocks at some point after this, you know, blow off is over. But I, you know, on a nominal basis, I think we probably just keep marching higher, a lot higher. And last time I was on Kevin Muir's show, you know, I mentioned we all think of hedging as left-tail hedging, you know, hedging for downside risk, hedging for a collapse. And I think investors should really take more seriously moving forward right-tail hedging, having something in place where, you know, you're protecting yourself if things get unhinged to the upside. And I really think that's going to be, you know, super important going forward. And I haven't seen anything about a hedge fund that just specializes in right tail hedging, but I suspect we will see that, you know, in the months and years ahead. And I think it'll be probably an important part for, you know, an institution's portfolio to have a little slice of right tail hedging.
Yeah, no, it makes perfect sense. And in a lot of ways, you could say that's what that momentum algorithmic portfolio we use was, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
It's sticking to our value roots, but at the same time, you know, and it's done beautiful at that. It's really muted out the underperformance of value, because overall we've been very competitive, if not better than the S&P, with a fraction of the volatility. And yeah, it completely is a right tail hedge. Now, one of the other, in being a guy that's based in value, I've learned the value of looking at technicals more than I ever have in the past. But being a guy, it's really hard for me to have these conversations, because I'd be lying to you when I look at this valuation scenario and I look at the Fed's actions. And it's just amazing. And I want to get into a perfect example. Again, you and I discussed this the other day, but I think it'd be great for the listeners. And I think it'd be great for the listeners to watch it. But it's been wildly, and I'll get into that in a second, but it's been wildly frustrating for me, because you sit there and you watch things like Tesla, right? Is the most valuable automobile manufacturer in the world, and they're a dumpster fire, right? They're a mess of a company. You look at these tech companies, like you said, you know, you look at them and you go, listen, I can't tell you whether the stock's going to go up, stock's going to go down. What I can tell you is, at some point, for whatever reason, a stock with that kind of valuation, it's going to wreck people. There's no substance to the valuation, right? It's just completely detached from all sense of reality. And the idea that we're going to have to endure that for longer is exhausting. Now, before we get into the conversation about the debate that we witnessed and that you and I discussed, there's also the possibility, right, that because we are very much skating on thin ice. I mean, the way I see it is, I agree with you. I think that the path of least resistance is higher. I think it's also the pain trade at this point. I think that it looks to me like we're not just going higher, that we're going way higher. And the reason I say that is, again, looking at the technicals, looking at the, it's also the speed at which we break through these resistance levels. It's not even a big deal. And if something turns red, unless it's volatility, if something turns red, it seems like it stays there only for like a seconds and people buy it up. It's just the appetite is just insatiable. And so it just feels to me either like the apex or a blow off top, or it just seems to me like something that just isn't going to fatigue. But in that backdrop, truly, though, we're only one headline away, and I don't know what that headline would be. But when you're in a situation like this, it's also a bit precarious, isn't it? Because at any moment, you know, when you're floating on Ethereum like this, something can pull that magic carpet out from underneath you, and you can, reality can present itself in a hurry, can't it?
Yes, definitely. And the weird thing about watching the markets right now is I feel like, and I think most people would agree, whether they're bullish or bearish, if you just look at the chart, it is just, it's really easy to imagine it based on fundamentals and technicals. It's kind of easy to imagine us being a lot higher or a lot lower in 6 weeks. It makes it, you know, it's a very tough environment.
Well, yeah. And then because the other side of it is valuation has always been a way marker, right? A point to kind of tell you where you're at. But this market, and again, it's nothing new. But this market has repeatedly said, we literally do not care. And not only do we not care, but we are going to run away from any sense of value. And we are going to double, triple, and quadruple down on the things that are the most ridiculous. And it's almost become narrative investing, right? Sell me the best story. I don't even care if it's true or not, right? Yeah, I don't even care if a company reeks of fraud. Sell it to me because of the story. I just love the bloody story.
Yeah, and a lot of that, you know, you're getting is hundreds of thousands of individual trading accounts have been opened this year, and you're getting a lot of small money that is just, you know, day trading, especially with work from home during the virus and $1,200 stimulus checks. You're getting retail participation on a level that we just haven't seen in a long time, and it's
99,
and it's all bullish. You know, like it's not, you know, no one's out there fading stocks or shorting anything or buying puts. It's all loading up on calls, and it's buying story stocks. And interestingly, it's buying things that have been getting beat up. You know, you had Robinhood traders just pile into Hertz before they declared bankruptcy. You know, they're buying airlines and cruise lines, GE, like Boeing, anything that has kind of been on fire in the last, in a bad way in the last few months is what they're loading up on. Story stocks and beaten down stocks. You know, they want to be they want to buy what's, you know, the blood in the streets, and then they want to buy the stuff that they think is cool.
Right. Yeah.
It's getting to be, you know, usually that kind of trading is just not that important to the overall market. And I think now it's starting to actually get important to the overall market.
The other thing that has shocked me, and it's a constant reminder, my wife has gotten to the point now where she reminds me of this all the time. And I don't want people to read into this the wrong way. Cause if I ever don't seem like a humble person, I don't think you know me well enough. Don't get me wrong. I'm not the most humble individual in the world, but when it comes to this markets, I am incessantly humble. And the reason why is because I've had my head kicked in before. You know, we all know that we're one trade away from disaster, and you know, in my opinion, you've got to be very well aware of, you know, the Icarus like nature of all of us when it comes to the markets, right? You fly too close to the sun, you're going to melt. And this acknowledgement that, you know, that you can be wrong, and that you can be wrong in a big way. What has been fascinating to me, again, and this whole scenario that we're currently in highlights it, is this whole way of looking at markets and looking at the economy. And this is where I want to get into this topic of the debate. But where my wife comes in, and why she constantly reminds me of this, is she always reminds me, remember, honey, because she's heard me say it so many times, very few people, and it's shocking, you know this to be true too, so few people, even ones that are on the TV, especially ones that are on the TV, actually. So few people in this industry do the work. It is such an echo chamber, right? You get up there and you hear these people say things that have become popular. One of my favorites of all time was, do you remember the narrative from really Gold's top in 2011 till the first Fed rate hike, which occurred in, was it 16, I want to say, 17, something like that? I think it was 16. Or was it the end of 15? Anyway, somewhere there.
I think it was December 16, sounds right.
Yeah, that sounds right. So the narrative up until that point was, you can't buy gold because we know that interest rates are going to go up, and interest rates going up are horrible for gold. Do you remember that narrative?
Vaguely, yes.
Okay. Well, as a gold guy at the time, we didn't have a lot of investments in gold just because it was a death wish. But we were very much looking for a resurgence in gold, and it drove me nuts because on a inflation adjusted basis, the all time high for gold occurred during a rapidly rising interest rate environment, right? And gold typically does its best when inflation is high, which typically is accompanied by what? Higher interest rates. It was a completely vapid, meaningless, stupid narrative. And yet you heard strategist after strategist say it and reinforce it. So we came up with a strategy where we said, okay, here's the deal. We believe everybody is completely off on this, and we've got the data to back it up. And the first time the Fed hikes rates, we are going to go hard into gold. Sure enough, the Fed hikes at the end of 2016. We go hard into gold. Gold rallies 25% over the next 3 months, right? Just completely blowing that thesis up in everybody's face. And it cracked me up because all you had to go back and do is go look at interest rates and gold prices and see the intersection there that happened in the 80s and go, this entire story is a false premise. And yet everybody and their mother just kept parroting it and echoing it, right? It was a giant echo chamber. And it just shocks me how few people in this industry do their homework. And I don't think anything can clear that up more than the little debate, little on-air spat we saw this week with a younger guy by the name of Andrew Ross Sorkin. And for those of you that don't know, I believe he's a co-developer of the name of the show Billions. And he's written some good books, sharp guy. And then the old stalwart on CNBC, Joe Kernan, they got in a very uncomfortable, testy tit for tat. And Kernan goes off on him at one point and goes, look, you've been wrong about panicking about the virus and panicking about the economy. And you've been wrong about this, wrong about that. And I just sat back, and I think investors should all go watch that. You Google Joe Kernan and Andrew Ross Sorkin, because the thing that was incredible to me was Kernan was saying he was wrong about everything. And the only thing Kernan could point to say that he was wrong was where the stock market was at. But every assertion that Andrew Ross Sorkin made was absolutely correct. He's like, you were wrong about the economy. And I'm sitting there going, Joe, you're going to see a 35 to 40% hit in Q2 alone. You've got depressionary level unemployment. What are you talking about? He was wrong about the economy. If anything, he was too bullish. Right? I mean, you haven't seen it get any worse than that. And it's this not incessant, because it to me at least, it seems fairly new. It's that we will ignore all other data. If stocks are up, things are okay. If stocks are down, things are bad. Did you see that debate? You and I discussed it. I don't know if you watched it. And then B, what do you attribute that to? Because I'm listening to a guy like Joe Kernan, been on the air for a long time, interviewed great money managers. And I just, again, it was one of those jaw drop moments where I thought, Joe, you can't think everything is like, what are you talking about? Nothing other than the stock market reaction to this. That's the only thing he was wrong about. I'd love to hear your thoughts, because I just sat there and the funny thing is that, and I promise I'm going to let you answer this question. But the funny thing is that I have seen this from retail investors. It's that we will ignore all reality. As long as stocks are going up, it's good news. What do you, that has existed for some time. It's what bubbles are made of and all that kind of stuff. I get that, but it seems to be extraordinarily pervasive. What do you attribute that to? And have you noticed that?
Yeah, I've definitely noticed it. And I did see their very uncomfortable debate.
Oh, it was awkward.
So, you know, the stock market has just for a long time been an important scoreboard that people have pointed to. And there was a point in time where, you know, when it kind of closely mirrored the economy, where it made sense to use it as a scoreboard to kind of see where you're at. Obviously, for all the things we've talked about today, it's not anymore. But, you know, it's just sort of still there. Like a lot of people still want to use it that way because they have, you know, their whole career. But, you know, when the stock market's doing what you want, it's when it's doing what maybe your tribe wants, then you're definitely going to point to it as, you know, social proof that you're right and the people that disagree with you are wrong. So I think that was just sort of natural. But yeah, you're definitely right that we use it as a barometer of too much. You know, it doesn't tell us anything about health or well-being or happiness or, you know, societal, you know, harmony. Like there's so many things it doesn't tell us. It tells us where stocks are, not the economy, you know, nothing about politics. It just tells us, you know, where stocks are these days anyway. And I've jokingly putting too much meaning into it. It's dangerous, I think.
Yeah, I've started saying that the stock market has been rendered as a liquidity gauge, right? Liquidity goes down, prices go down. Liquidity goes up, prices go up. It really has been that simple over the last decade. I mean,
it's become a policy tool as much as anything.
Yeah. I think that's a brilliant way to put it. Yeah, it's a policy tool. We want to shape the reality. And frame things in a nice way. So we got to have higher stock prices. Okay. So to close this up, and I've kept you for way too long here and I appreciate your time. What are the other key things that you don't think that we have? And the whole point of this really was to explain what liquidity driven markets were, what we meant by that, why we're so confident that that is the case to me and you. I know it seems self-evident. And I think the best illustration of that is how do you justify, you know, record high prices and record high valuations in an economic catastrophe? Is there anything else that you would like to add to it or anything else that investors should know or the general public out there needs to know? And and you can address it any way you'd like. My biggest thing, and not trying to pitch our book at all or talk our book, but just saying, I really think that investors need a portfolio with hedges on both tails. You know, you got to be loaded for bear, you know, regardless of, you know, what you think may or may not happen. You also can't be bared up sitting on treasuries and cash, because of the liquidity dynamic. Is there anything else that you think that would help them to hear from you or other things that they'd be good to keep in mind or be cognizant of to help them understand and navigate these markets?
Sure. I think looking really big picture at kind of what's to come in the future and like what some important things to watch for are going to be like for if this plays out the way I think it will. Some of those things, like we talked about, debt levels are just too high. And, you know, wealth distribution is a little too skewed, and both of those things work together. They reinforce each other and they really hold everything back. So knowing that and policymakers definitely, they know that, like the things you need to look for moving forward to see if we're going to get this, you know, change in the way that's structured and go to an inflationary outcome where real assets, you know, commodities, things like that start to do really well. What you're kind of looking for there is, you know, some of the low hanging fruit things like student debt. You know, millennials are a huge generation. They're a generation that really has no wealth. And one of the ways to help them get rid of their debt is going to be to forgive student loans. It's going to be, you know, government programs that subsidize, you know, things like childcare that forgive debt, not just, you know, student debt, but other kinds of debt. Things like that is what you kind of want to look for. And all that's going to seem really extreme and really crazy. But the only way to put money into the hands of people that actually spend it, the working and middle class, and to, you know, to put some in the hands of millennials is going to be some extreme policy like that. And whether you think it's great or terrible is, you know, immaterial. Watch for it to happen because of the consequences, you know, financially, if it does happen, because then if you have the biggest generation in America that all of a sudden has a lot less debt hanging over it, they would actually be able to go out and spend. You know, look for policies that are redistributive and that do cancel out or forgive debts. Because I think, you know, everyone's looking for a big debt jubilee, you know, because at the end of a long-term cycle where you have huge debt levels, that's what you get. You get debt forgiveness. And I think people look for, you know, some big, you know, button that someone pushes where a bunch of debt goes away. It's not going to work out that way. It's going to be, Congress is going to find ways to get money to people, and the Federal Reserve is going to supply the money to make that happen. That's why I think that their balance sheet will be $50 trillion. And I think some of that's going to be student loans. It's going to be maybe even, you know, credit card forgiveness or mortgage forgiveness. Like I think, you know, it'll be staggering the things that we see go through Congress. And I think big business is going to be held to account, you know, more than we're used to when it comes to the way they deploy capital and the way they treat workers. Some of that will be good, some of it will be bad. But at the end of the day, the labor share of the economy is going to go up. You know, wages are going to go up in the next decade. And all of these things will make inflation higher, and they'll make, you know, real assets go higher, whether it's, you know, forestry or it's gold or it's copper or oil. You know, real stuff is all of a sudden going to be needed more versus, you know, just buying more of your own shares. And if there's more demand coming from real people, then businesses have a reason to actually invest their money instead of just let it pile up and buy back their own stock or hand it out to investors. So when I think about, you know, the next 10, 20 years, those are the kinds of things I think people should be watching out for. It's the kind of things that's going to create inflation, that's going to have stocks go higher than we think makes sense, but it's also going to have real assets go higher. So yeah, that's kind of my big picture moving forward viewpoint that for some stuff that I think is important, some big trends, some big shifts in the way that things are done politically and monetarily that everyone should definitely have on their radar.
Yeah, and to be clear, I think that the one thing that's undeniable is it's all of those things coming together has put investors in a very tough place. And, you know, I understand the retail sentiment about wanting to push the pedal to the metal and that everything's great. I mean, it's not, and unfortunately they're wrong, but I understand that impetus, right? I look at how many fake scares, you know, they weren't fake, but look at how many scares. And rightfully for on the bearish side, which we have been multiple times. You know, I think we were a little more cognizant of the Federal Reserve's ability to print, and so we weren't as bared up and therefore didn't get hurt as bad as some other people. But, you know, you look at the multiple, this is obviously the biggest example, but you look at multiple disruptions we have had over the last 10 years. We probably should have had multiple downturns that were significantly larger than they were. Again, this one being the largest. And that were just papered over, right? They're just papered over. And I understand people's mindset of feeling they're bulletproof, that the Fed's got their back and there's nothing to go wrong. I mean, it's been remarkable. Yet at the same time, I also think that investors, especially those approaching retirement or in retirement, I think they really need to do what we call manage to the bogey, which is, you know, manage their money in such a way as to keep up with inflation, hit their individual retirement goals, but to do so in such a manner as that they are taking as little risk necessary as necessary to accomplish that goal. Because I think you and I both would agree that the tough part about these scenarios is you just, once you have completely separated from fundamentals, there are no markers, right? There's no way really. I mean, you can look at technicals, but you know, there's really no way to tell when you're getting stretched, right? I mean,
right. That's where history comes in. It's so important because, yeah, you talked about, you know, we talk about all these talking heads on, you know, on financial media and how they just kind of, they don't do the work, or they, you know, to start parroting narratives that kind of work, or they wrap a story around what's happening that kind of makes sense. And the reality is, like, you know, what we're facing now hasn't happened. And I'm not talking about the virus. I'm just talking about the economy and the markets. What's happening now hasn't happened in about 80, 90 years. So, you know, the average person's not going to, the average investor, professional or not, is not going to do enough studying of what happened the last time this kind of scenario unfolded, whether that's, you know, political cycle or economic cycle. And that's, to me, that's where the answers lie, are, you know, they're in history. So taking those moments, you know, really seriously, post-World War II or Great Depression, or even going back to some of the times we had in the 1800s in, you know, Europe or the US, even 1700s, there's a lot to be learned about what happens to currencies, what happens to, you know, equity markets whenever we get into a situation like we have now, you know, both politically and financially.
Yeah, it's a complicated, and it's, again, if investors at home are sitting there going, oh, it seems it is. It is really complicated, and that's, again, not talking our book, but that's why we've constructed our portfolios the way we have, which is, you know, we've got defensive mechanisms built into everything we do, yet at the same time, we're positioned in such a way that if the market's going up, we're going up with it. And you just... Because the other interesting thing, and I'll let you go, I promise we'll wrap this up. But the other interesting thing is you might sit there and go, well, it's all about delineating between, you know, the 25 to 30% pullback and the buying opportunity and when the 25 to 30% is going to turn into the 60%. Well, okay, great. That's great to say. But the event that we're looking at right now should have been a 70 to 80% downdraft, right? So how do you delineate between those two? You don't. And we have seen now... You know, it was really interesting. I was listening to Liz Ann Saunders, who is a strategist or a chief market person for Schwab. I think she's really sharp. It was really interesting, though. I was listening to her comments the other day, and she goes, you know, and she's one talking about valuations being stretched. And you know, I think that she is somebody that does her homework, and I respect her view. But she also said something that was really funny. She goes, there at the bottom when we were down 36%, she goes, the market was pricing in a really bad economic outcome. And I thought that take was staggering, because I said to her, I didn't say to her, but I was looking at that and going, well, hold on a second. There at the bottom, we were at a 17.5 to 18 PE price to earnings ratio on the S&P. That's not a negative outcome, right? And that was
an expensive market of yesteryear.
Right. Yeah. Exactly. That was an above average expense market. This wasn't pricing in some kind of depression. And it's just, it's so bizarre to me how investor perception has been warped so bad by this. And she goes, we were anticipating a really bad outcome. And I was like, well, do you mean like 20 to 25% unemployment? Right. The plane crashed. Reminds me of the Big Lebowski when, you know, he's like, the plane has hit the side of the mountain. I'm sitting there going, we got our horrible negative economic outcome. And here we are with markets. So it's just fascinating. Hey, if nothing else, it's interesting, right? It's, may you live in interesting times.
That's for sure.
We can check that off our list. Anyway, Chase, well, hey, appreciate you coming on again and playing counterparty to me on this and laying this out. Hopefully our listeners and investors and anybody else listening to this, hopefully that kind of clears up you know, what liquidity-driven markets mean, what we mean by that, the Fed's role in all of this, and hopefully it provides them some insight. So thanks so much for coming on and doing that with me.
Yeah, pleasure to be on, as always. Appreciate you having me.
Oh, anytime, pal. All right, you guys. Well, thank you so much for listening, and hope you enjoyed it. I know that was a longer one, but we just really wanted to lay that out for people to understand, you know, how we got here, where we've come from, and where we're headed, and most importantly, the need for both safety and what I think Chase refers to very aptly and very concisely as right tail hedges. You cannot be bared up. You also can't be running, you know, pedal to the metal, because at any moment, that's really the insidious thing about this whole situation, is that, yeah, it looks like the path to least resistance is higher. We thought it was a bear market rally. Until we set new all-time highs, that's still going to be my take on it. But at the same time, I will tell you right now, it doesn't look like that's the case. It very much looks like this is going to go higher. And rather than being frustrated by that or digging in your heels, make a plan that has right tail hedges and left tail hedges that will ensure that you will be fine either way. Utilize the advantage you have. You are not a hedge fund. Your job is not to beat the S&P 500 every year. Your job is to finance the rest of your life, and those are two very different things. So just make sure you're not getting out too far on one tail or the other, because it can and probably will hurt you. Anyway, well, thank you again for listening. We will be back next week. Hopefully you join us. And that's it for us today. You're listening to Know Your Risk Radio on AM 770 KTTH and 97.3 Cairo FM.
Thanks for listening to Know Your Risk Radio with Zach Abraham, Chief Investment Officer at Bulwark Capital. Whether it's preservation of capital or an aggressive growth strategy, every investor needs a clearly defined risk profile. Schedule your free risk review with Zach Abraham now at knowyourriskradio.com. Zach will be back with more Know Your Risk Radio next Saturday at noon on 97.3 Cairo FM and AM 770 KTTH.
Opinions expressed in this program are for general information purposes only and are not intended to provide specific advice or recommendations for any individual or any specific security. It is only intended to provide education about the financial industry. To determine which investments may be appropriate for you, consult your financial advisor prior to investing. Any past performance discussed during this program is no guarantee of future results. Any indices referenced for comparison are unmanaged and cannot be invested into directly. As always, please remember investing involves risk and possible loss of principal capital. Please seek advice from a licensed professional. Bulwark Capital Management is an investment advisor representative of Clear Creek Financial Management, a registered investment advisor.